Okay, here we go. So, today's guest has shaped how consumers experience brands on two very different stages. Barbara Gorder has built her career at agencies like Leo Burnett and DDB, creating award-winning campaigns for global icons and earning recognition from Cannes Lions and Effies along the way. For the past 15 years, she's turned that same strategic rigor to our wine world, helping lead the Direct-to-Consumer Wine Symposium and guiding wineries as they learn to think like brands. Barbara's perspective is rare. She understands both the discipline of world-class advertising and the scrappy realities of today's D2C evolution. This conversation is about how good advertising actually works, the process behind campaigns that stick, the discipline that fuels creativity, and the lessons wine can take from the broader world of advertising. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Polly. It's very generous of you. I appreciate it.
Well, I have followed you on social for ages and the work that you do with Undisclosed Location. That's your strategic consultancy that's there in Sonoma, right?
Yes, indeed.
And you know what prompted me to reach out to you was that I saw an interview that you did with MJ Towler. Is that right? And you were talking about psychographics as opposed to demographics. And this is a big, big thing like that we try to get our clients to really embrace is this notion that, you know, demographics is very old school and there's a lot of reasons that it doesn't help build affinity. And I was like, oh, okay, we need to get her on the podcast. So see, it just you're just going to go from one podcast to the next, to the next, to the next. What I thought we would do today, though, because I know that you do so much work in wine, but I actually wanted to kind of roll back a little bit and talk about advertising and how it works. And I'm going to start at a real basic, which is, can you walk me through the process of, maybe it's not that basic, big process. Can you walk me through the process of developing a campaign or being able to develop a campaign that sticks with people? Like, where do you start and how do you know when you found the right idea?
I think there's a couple different ways that you can think about that, more than a couple, but I'll just sort of segment them into two things. I think it's, do you have an existing brand? And what does that mean and where you might start? And that is going to be a different rigor than a lot of people that I work with. I do a lot of work with new brands where you're creating a new brand and then launching it. So if you have an existing brand, you have to get people to understand what does that mean exactly? And then what does it mean to people? And to whom are you talking is always the most important thing that you have to sort out. New, old, existing, do you want to talk about, you know, how do you want to do that? So who is the customer or who is the potential customer for that particular?
And who brings that research? So when you're working for someone like Leo Burnett, right, you're working for a big ad agency. Is that part of your mandate as an agency to go out and do that research? Or is it expected that the client will have already conducted that and have an idea of who those consumers or ideal consumers would be?
It has to do with, I mean, Procter & Gamble, who's been doing this since the 1920s, right, has an enormous history and an enormous rigor around analytics, consumers, focus groups, product development. So somebody like that is going to bring a wealth of information to the party. Or if you're talking to a brand new tech entrepreneur, they're probably not going to have a lot of information. So you end up as a creative person. You have to make hay with what you're allowed to make hay with. And so there's a lot of different ways of doing it. Today, we have so many tools at our disposal in terms of how to research things and find them. It's much different than when I started at Leo Burnett in 1991, right?
Right.
So at that point, it was run more like, you know, Burnett's model was more like a McKinsey model. So Burnett it was a steaming cauldron of very creative people, not just the creative department, but research department was extraordinary with PhD level people. And you had, you know, account people who at that time often had MBAs. So you had a lot of people into the mix in terms of finding out what you had. sometimes people would just come down to your office and talk, but right. it was a lot different. Today, it's a more singular activity, and you want to talk about when you get down to wine, it's often who's coming to your tasting room, what do your analytics look like in terms of what are you selling them? So
you and then, of course, what are your goals? Are you happy with the people who you've got already? Are you trying to reposition? Are you, you know, premium? Yeah. We won't talk premiumizing, but are you premiumizing? Yeah. So
it's just you end up with a lot of different inputs, shall we say.
So one of the things that we certainly deal with, and, you know, I think exists in wine, but probably exists everywhere, is the loudest voice in the room or the highest paid person in the room having possibly more weight to their requests, to their needs, to their opinions than is necessarily healthy for a brand. So when you're looking
I've never seen that before, Polly. Come on.
Oh, I know. What are we talking about?
Well, it doesn't just happen in wine, believe me.
Yeah, right. And so I wonder when you're in a large organization like that, you know, how do you sort of set expectations for how a client is going to get the very best results? And this is all actually leading somewhere in wine. Just for anybody who's listening, it's like, why are they talking about agency work? You know, how do you help them understand what they need to do to make successful campaigns or to make a campaign
a
success?
What we had at Burnett was we had a very rigorous creative review process. And that was basically you got up and pitched to the team. And that was usually research, planning, account management, your creative leaders. Sometimes if it was really important, it was the head of the agency. And so you have to basically sell why this is the best way to go. And there's multiple ideas presented. And so it's weighed based on a number of factors, but it's definitely, it allows you as a creative person to prioritize what's going to make the sale, why is it going to be good, and to develop the it's going to do this, 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 and this to the market. So there's a real, you know, there's four box systems. There's a lot of technical stuff in there, right. But it's reviewed by the brains who are going to the client. And then when you get to the client, hopefully everybody is on the same page. That doesn't always happen, but most of the time you are, and somebody calls the ball and says, this is what we're doing. And then you have backups. I mean, I had a boss, Judith Wormy, who used to say, agencies are like bakeries. You know, we sell cakes and cookies and pies and donuts. What do you want?
Right. I mean, so the reason I ask is that I often worry, because now kind of bring wine in a little bit. I worry that wine very much exists within our own echo chamber, right? Within our own bubble. And it sounds like when you're in that space and you're having to pitch, you know, you'll have multiple teams putting their ideas forward, that there's a richness of ideas, right? And you do have this sense of collaboration and, you know, you are competing for what is ultimately a dollar, but is actually for the best campaign. When we turn that to the work that you do with wine brands and how wine adopts or doesn't adopt advertising, you know, do you have some recommendations for pieces of this approach that a small to medium-sized winery could actually onboard to end up with better campaigns or to better brief their own marketing partners?
The best thing that happens to the creative process is having an excellent creative brief, always, and having a tight creative brief. And that's what actually makes it work. Because oftentimes in the wine world, there are people that jump in at the 11th hour, maybe it's the CEO, maybe it's a winemaker. And there's a lot of people who have a lot of opinions, but perhaps don't come from that rigor. But they have ideas and they want to participate in the process. But if you have a tight brief that is crafted at the beginning of the process, where this is the strategy, this is what the objective is, this is who the target consumer is, and this is what the intention, you know, this is what we're going to do. Let's say drive traffic to your tasting room or whatever that is. Then when those people come in who perhaps don't have as much experience or they've got some wild hair idea that they want to do, you can point to, but you agreed to the brief.
So I know that you've also talked a lot about packaging, right? Packaging in some sense as even campaigns themselves, as strategies themselves. Can you just speak a little bit about that?
So I love packaging. I've been doing packaging since I started. I mean, my background was as a designer. And that's how I started before I worked in advertising agencies, I worked as a designer. So I have a love for great design. And I think when you look at great creativity that exists inside the wine space, oftentimes you see it on the bottle. And a lot of that is for a variety of reasons. If you're in distribution, there is an enormous amount of focus on the label, probably too much. Don't get me wrong, it's a very lucrative aspect of the business, but some of the embellishments, as they call it, I mean, I've seen things that really were shocking to me in terms of like, people were spending less on driving traffic to the brand from a sales perspective, like to the website, for example, especially in the DTC world, whereas they were like spending thousands and thousands of dollars on packaging because they felt it was the only face that they were putting forward. And when, you know, there's somewhere around 34,000 SKUs annually in the wine world, I always like to think about my first trips to like Chicago, when I used to go into Sam's Liquors, which was this great place. And it was kind of in a bad neighborhood, and you went in and it was like this vast warehouse of stuff. And then you went down into the basement and you would see cases of like DRC and all kinds of wine brands, and they would dig out stuff for you. Wow. So it's like, it was really cool. It was a super cool place back in those days, back in the 90s. But the point is that there's a vast amount of it. And if you're not really on the page of, geez, I really like Albarino and we're doing oysters tonight, which is like, you know, this much audience, yeah, versus I want a white wine that goes with dinner and I'm on my way to a dinner party, you know, and I was back in those days, that's where I was, right? And yeah. So I would rely often on, you know, sales professionals that were in the store, or you're just looking at a bottle. But I think some of it's kind of gotten out of hand, and let's put it this way. I think you have to look at advertising from a holistic standpoint, and the wine business doesn't do a great job at reaching out to the consumers, which quite frankly, wine as a beverage needs to be sold. I mean, Rob McMillan certainly talked about it when they were doing the Wine Ramp project. There have been other efforts. I mean, if we're going to compete in the CPG space, we need to be on the list of those consumers. But just doing a nice wine label ain't going to cut it.
Well, this is kind of why I started with advertising, because one of the things that I notice is wine on the whole, I love my industry, but wine can be very wine centric, right? It can be we live in our own heads. It's all of these things like the Albarino and the oysters or whatever it is, the tropes that we use over and over and over again. And I do think that the packaging it's an enormous part of that. It's got some key challenges in terms of distribution, compliance, costings, patents,
it's not good.
So it's not like the easiest hurdle, right, to jump. Mm-hmm. But I suppose that there's also a sense that people tend to feel, and I'm curious if you think this is right or wrong, that the only way that you can differentiate yourself on a shelf is through an expensive label. If not that expensive label, then what else? What on that, at that moment on that shelf, how do they catch somebody's eye? And I'll give a little bit of background on this. Every time we come to the States, my business partner and I go and we hit up all of the major grocery and like bottle shop sellers. And we stand there taking pictures at the orange section and the blue section and the red section. And we're like, okay, right now, if you've got a Pinot Gris or Sauv Blanc, you've got a blue label and this is orange. You know, like it feels almost like we're always chasing, you know, catching up with the Joneses, as my grandmother would say. So how do you stand out?
I think having a good label is good. Don't get me wrong. I think it's a low bar. You have to have it. But at the same time, a client who shall remain nameless did 70 different rounds of changes on a single label.
That's a bad brief right there.
No, it was just somebody who didn't care about the brief.
Wow. Okay.
And so my point is that that's what happens in the wine world when there's no rigor about what happens. We live in great times for wine. in one respect, is because there are opportunities that one can take advantage of. And I've been talking about OTT and CTV for about 8 years now, and it's finally coming into its own. So you're seeing it on feeds, you're seeing it on IG. There are places where small brands can compete between the tools that you have in AI in terms of creation tools, in terms of what you're able to do in terms of democratic media. So streaming exploded during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so now it's like, you know, I've been watching The Morning Show, like rewatching it because it's coming. They're going to do season 4 of The Morning Show. And I think that's one of the, it's a great primer on what's happened to American television. Mm. And to see what, you know, and they great actors and whatever. But the point is that we all used to be doing the same things. Now we're all doing different things. But what something like OTT allows you to do is if you want to go and sell in the top 10 zip codes in Los Angeles, you can do that. You can be super granular. Yeah. I mean, you need the reach and that's not great, but we're going to be talking about that at the DTC show. I'm going to give people a boot camp on it because literally you can be a mom and pop and you can be part of that and you can go to where your customer, you have a lot of customers in Colorado. Great. Okay, let's go there. But we've never had that opportunity before. If you look at some of the things that are going on about wine campaigns with the WIDs and the different, you know, regions in California, this is something that wine can really do well. We don't have to have the money that you used to have for USDA campaigns like Beef It's What's for Dinner, Got Milk. You can do test markets. You can A-B test stuff. You can A-B test different creative ideas. You can go to very singular communities or just major metros in like San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, and just test things. And you don't have to make the investment that you used to have to make. So in a way, even though we've been going through difficult financial times in the wine business, the tools both in creation and media are there for people to be successful if they want to get into it. But right. You have to change the mindset first.
So a couple of the things that we notice that relate to that. One is that, because like I've been trying to get wine to really embrace YouTube for probably 5 years now, that I'm like, this is such a rich, fabulous place to collaborate, to co-create, to produce your own content, you know, and as YouTube, and now with TikTok, like if you kind of go this this continuum of how video production has changed, it used to be very high production, and now, in fact, you can have, you know, super low phone videos that can.
And that's what the algorithms reward, quite frankly, which I think is weird, but.
Yeah. Okay. But the thing that I notice more than anything is lack of knowledge leads to fear around adoption or lack of transparent information leads to a misunderstanding of budgets. And sometimes that means that they inflate the budgets or that they're looking at budgets that are lower than they need to be. And we have really pushed for leaders to invest in your marketing team. Like marketing has changed a lot for wine. Wine has adopted a lot. So for leadership to say, to acknowledge that their team needs to understand what people are talking about when they're talking about, you know, out of home or streaming advertisement or any, you know, any of the new media, so that they can make better decisions.
Totally. And I think it's also about, again, this goes back to understanding and knowing your customer base, right? I was talking to Elaine Chukin Brown, who's going to be at the conference, and she and I are, and she's brilliant. And, you know, I mean, she writes for wine publications and, sure. You know, she has an audience, and we're talking about Isis Daniel, who's like the millennial psalm. And Isis has, you know, 140,000 people on TikTok. They're talking wine. They're both talking about wine, but they're talking to different audiences, which is great, which is what we should be encouraging. You know, they're different people. They're talking to different people. Let's get everybody in on it.
Absolutely. So I suppose that then leads into the ongoing tension between strategy and tactics, and what I call shiny new toy syndrome. So if you are going back to how all of this worked in the days of, you know, your days of advertising and advertising for major CPG brands, what advice could you give about defining strategy and then understanding the tactics that support those strategies for wine brands who maybe they don't have a lot to invest, they lack the knowledge to really feel confident?
Well, I would say differentiation, differentiation, differentiation. And
From whom? Tell it to, I mean, honestly, talk about other wine brands.
because if you see, I mean, you work in the wine business. How many times have you seen the story? My dad got into wine, or I bought this property and it's a family run business. It's what I call my guide dog truck strategy, which is when I moved here, there were like 15 years ago, that's 85% of the websites. And that was all it was. There was a guy, he had a truck, and there was a dog. Sometimes they were different, but you know, that was all it was. But there are people who are doing it. And I have started to see some more interesting things. Competition has increased hugely. And with the increase in competition, we've gone from around 7,500 to 11,000 wineries in the United States in about 5 years. So with increased competition comes the, what is your point of differentiation? And that's what you have to get back to. Who are you and why would I possibly be interested? And it has to be outside your family story. Your family may be interesting.
Right? I also say it can't be the quality of your wine. Like good quality drinkable wine is the baseline. Like it can't be, we make great wine.
Any advertising person will tell you that the most, and I have worked with the people, nice people at General Motors. Anybody will tell you, you cannot say quality. Quality is not a strategy. It's just like cool is not, if you say you're cool, you're definitely not cool.
Cool.
Right? It's just, you cannot say that. So what is going to give me the perspective as a consumer? Why am I going to do that? I mean, at the end of the day, look at what the spirits people are doing much more successfully. And it's not the most original creative, but even if you look at the Bordeaux crew did a great job. There's like a lot of different spirits people, and it's just people having a good time who look different and are in different places. It can't just be you and your family and everybody cheering and there's a sunset. Let's, you know, that's hoping for the best, and it's not going to work.
Well, today I just reported that Bullet Whiskey has entered into a content agreement with First We Feast, and that's the Hot Ones producers. And Sean Evans, who's the host of Hot Ones, is actually leading this series that they're doing for Bullet Whiskey that is all about, you know, people who have had a big dream and gone out and made it happen. It's got nothing at all to do with whiskey. It'll run across a YouTube audience of 15 million people, you know?
Fantastic.
The other one, just because I think that you'll appreciate this, the other one that came out recently is that Downy Fabric Softener has launched 4 20-minute audiobooks on a Spotify playlist, and they're all, what is it? It's called Downy's Scandalously Something Something Stories. They're romance stories. They have nothing at all to do with Downy Fabric Softener, but they do have to do with softness and touch and feel and luxe and like, and putting your feet up. It's so interesting to me.
That strategy is so old, it's new again, because that was how the original
soap operas.
That was how the original soap operas came out. And that's who sponsored them. And they were sold to housewives all over America. And that was how they got into American households, because women were the ones who were buying and continue
still
to
is.
Buy 85% of all household products.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
that's the whole thing is I love it. Okay, cool. I love that notion of we're not even talking about the product, you know, like that's one of the things that when I think we talk about all of these 11,000 wineries and of course the briefs that we all see is this notion of tell me everything about your brand that has nothing to do with your wine. You know, like what is, if you want to go with the unfair advantage, what is the thing that when people walk in and they meet you and the brand for the first time, what is the thing that they love, you know, and they come back time and again for? Or how is the tasting room? How do they talk about your brand? How does that 24-year-old who's serving in your tasting room on a Saturday, what are those beats that
come up? What kind of music are they listening to? What do they like?
I know.
I mean, I was just out. I had some friends in town from Sacramento, And like, we went out to Gunlake Bunshu because I thought they might like it, and they've never been there. And like, Jeff Bunshu's out spinning, you know, he's doing the DJ stuff on a Saturday afternoon. So that's involvement.
Yeah, that is involvement. And also, like, from a marketing standpoint, so like us with the work that we do with sites, and this is, I know that I will say this time and again across the podcast series, photography actually really matters. And when you can show a picture of your winemaker behind a deck DJing, that sends a very different message than a lot of the different versions of, you know, what we can show on a website or in an ad when we're trying to get somebody in the door.
Remember COVID and all these people and all the wineries were shut down, and I felt so bad for these people. They were like pushing winemakers onto Zoom calls with like club members, and a lot of these people had never talked to a public group before, and I was just like, it was painful to watch. There, I mean, some people are fantastic, but generally speaking, these are sometimes shy and retiring and nerdy people who are not generally used to talking.
I mean,
to the
you choose to be
public.
A farmer for a reason, I suppose. You know that there's a lot.
Some farmers are great, but I mean, yeah. You know, you've got, you know, not everybody can be Felcaturi. I mean, you know,
right.
No.
Right.
So it's like, how can you differentiate that? What does it look like? And to your point, what are the ideas? What's that overlapping Venn diagram of the idea? Like the downy softness thing is a great example.
Yeah. No? Yeah. We use something called the Kantar Meaningful Different Salient Framework that I actually think is awesome. That's okay. How are you creating meaning in their lives? How is it actually, you know, something that is differentiated? And how is it in fact salient? Like, how does that impact? How does that matter? How does that have insight? Like, what do you know about them? And I find that to be a really good tool that wineries can use themselves. I mean, it's well written up online that a in-house team could sit down with that. They can brainstorm through a workshop. They don't need to have a consultant in the room. You know, get everybody, get all of those 24-year-olds as well as the 84-year-olds in there and actually like really talk about it, which I think is such a good exercise for brands to be doing.
I have no idea why the wine business doesn't go after two markets that strike me as like really open for business. Okay, the wedding market. Come on. If you're serving that wine at your wedding, you're going to be drinking that for the rest of your life. That's the quintessential view of customer loyalty. Number one. Number two, the pet market. Okay. People spend a lot of money on their pets. They hang out with their pets. They play with their pets. They go hiking with their pets. Why is not someone taking those? I mean, those are just two super baseline examples of like, why aren't you doing something? And yes, are there dog friendly places? And I get it. But I mean, you can make more hay of this kind of stuff, you know, in terms of people's, it's not about how old they are, but how do they show up and what do you want to participate in? Because I think, to go back to the morning show references, we're not just getting our information from one or two places anymore. We're getting it from thousands of places. So there's the attention deficit is terrible. So anything that people are going to be emotionally involved with that make you feel something like a celebration, like your pet, those are the situations that you want to have identified with your wine brand.
It's interesting that you talk about all the many places that we can get our information and our data right now. When you're assessing or when you're thinking about how big brands assess the success of a campaign and turn that towards smaller wine brands right now, I know that, you know, obviously revenue is a key driver, but beyond that, what are the markers that you think brands should be looking at? What are the KPIs that maybe people are missing when they're sitting down and writing those briefs that have that long-term impact on their marketing, not just that immediate impact on their sales, which of course is a whole another piece of tension.
So I think one of the most interesting people who talks about this very successfully is Gary Vaynerchuk, right? So he sort of has the spaghetti at the wall approach, which is different than the way that I was raised inside of the CPG business. But for people who are digital, it's brilliant. And so basically, because I think we all come to problem solve with assumptions, including me, right? When people call me when they have problems, And then it's like, I come there thinking about if it's a brand I know, I'm thinking about that brand, I'll probably do some research or whatever. But there's all the stuff you don't know. So his point is that if you can do as many digital iterations, put it up, see what people will respond to organically, sometimes it's surprising. And then once you have those top winners, then start to fund those organic and repost, because it's a media way to do it. It's different, but it's from a small brand perspective, it's also incredibly effective.
I love that you say that, because one of the stories that we always tell is Tim Ferriss talking about how he named the books, that he spent $500, threw up a handful of sort of like landing pages, websites with a subscribe form, and then based the book title on, well, which one of those got the most hits? And one thing that like we really notice, what used to just be considered, you know, like digital user experience testing, now I can go online at any moment of a day and get 2,000 people testing ads, and it'll cost me next to nothing. And it's like, you know, and I think that actually that most people just don't know that that exists, that it's super, super easy to get rapid feedback on design. I mean, label design is such a great place to use it, right? Go out to market. And you can also do really interesting things around the concept of a public build where you're very transparent. And, you know, kind of leads me to another question, which is, what can we do collectively as an industry to get wine being more forthcoming and sharing of kind of the business knowledge and advice? I know certainly we have things like the symposium, but I notice that my brands or the brands I work with can be very cloistered around that information. They don't really want to share what's working.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's just sort of general gatekeeping. I want to go back to what you're talking about in terms of getting feedback from consumers. And mm-hmm. I just want to make this point to people, because it's important to have consumer feedback at different points in the process. But sometimes I've noticed weaknesses in the wine business where, to paraphrase what Steve Jobs said, the consumer is not going to solve your problem.
Right.
They don't know. They will never know. So don't expect for the consumer to solve what it is that is your issue.
That you don't know. Right.
So you have to make, and the other thing is when I worked at Burnett and when I worked at DDP, we had people who, they did nothing but analytics all day and twice on Sunday. You cannot take, you know, basically from my experience, any of the analytics systems that I've seen in the business, and they do not provide you with that sophisticated an outlook. So it's really important.
Oh, you've opened a big can of worms. Do you want to just talk about that a little bit?
Well, I just think it's important to understand that when you look at numbers, I think the quote is, even the devil can quote scripture, mm-hmm, something like that. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very careful with simplistic analysis. And I've seen people do this. So if you have a winery and it looks like you're selling one kind of wine more than another kind of wine, it's probably a fair set of complex attributions as to why that is. It's not going to be, hey, it's because white wine is hot. That's not it. You know, I mean, I'm using sort of a dumbed down example, but people are probably drinking, you know, during the summer months, people drink more white wine. Wow. You know, women often choose white wine as a cocktail. White wine tends to be lower in alcohol.
White wine is cheaper.
It's also cheaper. Thank you very much. So there could be, so the complexities around that need to be addressed. So just looking at your numbers inside of your
analytics dashboard.
On a dashboard is not, repeat, not solving your creative problem. It's necessary. I always say that observation is the mother of invention. If you really want to do that and you really want to go and meet your consumers, go out in your tasting room or go into a wine bar that's local. And, you know, I go to the Fairmont on Friday nights and just watch families and people. My husband would say, oh, local, you know, visitor. You know, how are they dressed? What are they drinking? Do they have kids? Do they have dogs? What are they, you know, are they there listening to the music? But observation is probably way more important than just your allocations or what happens in your numbers dashboard.
I love that you say that, because we have really fought to get qualitative, to like have a seat at the table, because I know that with the proliferation of dashboards, everybody's got a dashboard, right? That people like this idea that they can tether themselves to a number. They can go back, they can report. It's, as you say, it's all very simplistic. And from my perspective as a marketer, I agree with you 100%. Wine has got some of the best qualitative source that anybody will ever see, which is that tasting room. And in that tasting room, people want to talk about, why did they get there? Why do they love wine? What was the first wine that they ever drank? Like, this is something where people want to actually tell their stories. And so like the only place though that I give a tiny bit of a caveat on this is, I think that also requires a level of cultural awareness for the person who is undertaking that qualitative analysis, because I remember doing this with a brand. This is a Kiwi brand some years back. And we sat there, like GM, a couple of people in the tasting room. And we just sat there going through the people who were coming through in the tasting room in a day. And I remember saying to them, oh, look at that table of like five women sitting over there. Every one of those women have on a pair of shoes that cost over $1,000. And like, you know, it was a bunch of dudes. They had no idea. I'm like, you want to see who your target market is? Those women have sat here for 3 hours and they come in every week. You need to know, like, that's really important. Or, you know, there are other things. I know that Stryker Reese, who is a young man who works in wine on the East Coast, and he's doing a lot of work with subcultures. And he was, he linked in, this made me laugh so much. He linked in about the current New York mayoral campaign and Cuomo's social media team saying how their social media had gone great guns, without understanding that the reason it had gone great guns is because Mamdani's teams had turned it into memes. And like the whole thing, you know, like it was that notion of bad engagement.
Look at what Gavin Newsom's, the White House TikTok account. And so that's what, and so I think the one thing I wanted to say, okay, one, do humor. I will tell you this. This yes. is like, from a creative standpoint, do you ever see humor in wine? Just think about it.
No.
What is one of the most powerful things in advertising? Humor. What cuts through more than anything else? I mean, go back to like, the What's Up campaign that was done 20 years ago. Vinnie Warren's a friend of mine, and he did that campaign. He won everything for that. And, you know, he hired Charles Brown, and they did that campaign. And that campaign was sort of the beginning of the meme world.
Yeah.
Now they're resurrecting it, and they're doing it again.
Yeah.
But what is that commercial about? It is not about What's Up. It's about camaraderie while watching football and having a beer while you're doing it. It is about humor, and it is everlasting. And what I challenge the wine community is to do something funny, because people love humor. Could you alienate somebody? Possibly. But look at what the rewards are, because people will remember you. And that humor is something that is lacking in our industry. Let's not take each other so effing seriously.
So how do we do humor? So I've been writing about this for years. How do we do humor in wine? And why do you think that wine is not willing to do it?
Someone very smarter than I did, I think it was Susan Castrava, maybe said to me, wine people don't think wine is alcohol.
Yeah.
And so I think they think about it as art and culture, and you might roll in fine dining or cuisine or whatever it is. But all of these things can be funny. They all can be funny if we just don't take ourselves quite so seriously. But it's hard. It's hard to step out of that, because people will say, well, then people won't take my product seriously, and I'm charging $70 for my Pinot Noir. But, you know, I mean, there are a lot of brands. Look at some of the brands that step out and try and do humor. And I think that there's space for it in wine. And it's somebody should try it. Humor is tricky. And it's not for some tasting room associate. God love them all. But I mean, you have to hire a professional, because you have to split the baby. You have to do something that's brand right, but it can't alienate. It has to be something that is so, there's commonality to it. So it's not for everybody, and you do need to hire professionals. That would be my warning.
The other one that I notice, that wine could lean into more, I'd love to see them lean into more, is nostalgia, but not heritage, not old fashioned, like that sense of, cause I really see this working well. So if we talk about Downey going back to soap operas, or them bringing back the Share a Coke campaign, who was it? The cereal brand, I forget who it is. Cereal brand went back and did sort of the ads from the 1990s. So these things, I think it actually is interesting in that it is really tapping into a cultural memory of the people who right now have plenty of money to spend in wine, but it is doing it in a way that feels so less heavy, you know. And also, if you go into like sort of the Edelman data, if you look at the annual happiness report, if you look at trust data, what we're seeing is that levity is one of the things that people are continuing to search for. You know, if just this week, The Guardian was talking about how more and more people are turning off reading the news. And so how can you fill an emotional, right? So how can you fill this emotional space that is actually something we want to listen to? Do you remember ads in Europe back in the day? Like when we were growing up, ads in Europe, they were so funny and they were so silly. And I remember it happened because, and this is my understanding, somebody can correct me in the comments if I'm wrong, all the ads in France ran at the end of the program. They didn't cut That's them right. up. And so if you were going to get people to sit through your ads actually had to be enticing or compelling enough that you would sit through and watch
Usually
them. And so
they were naked
great
people.
Ads. Naked That's people on a beach and people. Sharks and things like that. But yeah, that sense of, well, how do we actually create marketing and ads that people are willing to give up their time to sit and listen to and look through and be enamored by?
Well, what I was going to say is I think the, you know, nostalgia goes in and out, right? But we live in what the Chinese might call interesting times. So because there is chaos that happens daily, weekly, monthly, everybody's sort of, we're in a very chaotic time across many categories. Nostalgia provides comfort, warmth, happiness, and gives you that perspective. So that's one reason why nostalgia is like reading high in trends right now.
Yeah.
And I would say getting people to watch is something that is compelling and different than what other people are doing. And so if you can do that and you can surprise people that it's a wine ad, why not? Because I think that's what you have to do, but you have to do it faster than they used to do. So you used to have 30 or 60 seconds. Now you've got about 5 seconds. Yeah. Got to get quicker.
So what lessons from CPG or luxury or GM do you think most directly apply to wine, that wine brands can look at it and just be like, yes, I don't have to think too much. That's something great I can take away tomorrow and implement.
It's tough because the budgets are a lot smaller. I think that what more brands might do better at is trying to identify what wines in their portfolio might be interesting to specific targets. And I'll use kind of basic examples. So we all know that Sauvignon Blanc has done very well in the last 2 years. We all know that the primary consumer of Sauvignon Blanc are women. So if I was a Sauvignon Blanc producer, I mean, obviously I'm making other wines, but I might think about centering on a product like that, because the biggest challenge with wine is it's in a bottle and you don't get to taste it before you buy it. So, but if I want to get known, I mean, look back in the day, like remember when Margarita, the Pinot Grigio that came to America,
yes,
right? And so they became known for Pinot Grigio. That's not their only brand, but I would say that would be something that I would think about doing. That would be like, okay, get known for something. What are you doing? I mean, you could probably do it to some extent from a placement, like, you know, the Roan Rangers has done a good job at pushing Roans. And I think, you know, coming back from that, I mean, Cabernet is its own sauce. But the point is that getting known for something is important, because you need to be something in order to market it. You can't just be, tasting good is a baseline. Yeah. And I think that a lot of people, and there's also, I mean, something that I'm sure you encounter all the time, is that marketing is not appreciated in the wine world. It's now needed.
I know, we are anathema.
But they need us now more than ever. And marketing and smart marketing can come in ways and shapes and forms and modalities. But the point is that in order to stand out, you must have something worth standing out. And that can't be, this wine is yummy. It needs to be something else.
I love that you said that, because I do, if I could add to it, I would say, and don't be afraid to lean in to fewer products well marketed, because I feel like whenever I see a client rolling out a new SKU, I'm like, well, a new SKU has a cost, you know, like a new SKU has a marketing and sales cost. And I, if anything, I would love to see.
Some people don't account for that in their COGS, however.
Yeah, I would love to see us actually.
It's the only category line of business I have ever worked in, period. And I have worked across many that doesn't have marketing as part of their COGS. If you ask any winemaker what his or her, you know, how much it costs to create a bottle, they can tell you. But marketing isn't part of that. No. You'd be fired from Procter & Gamble. You'd be fired from most brand posts in America if you proceeded in that fashion. You can't.
Yes, but you are working to solve that. At least once a year in a very big event, you are working really hard to solve that. So you want to tell me a little teeny bit about that before we wrap up?
Yeah, sure. So I've been working on the Direct-to-Consumer Wine Symposium since about 2009. And I started working on the content because I had a lot of US and European-based contacts, brought a lot of people from outside the wine business to have different perspectives. Conference has changed enormously. We have people from about 18 states. And I'm really excited about the content this year more than ever, because this is the first time I've had full, so it'll be all my fault, one way or another.
It'll be all your fault. So what awesome things are happening at this year's event?
We've got people like Elaine Chicken Brown is going to be there, Dusky Estes, and we're going to talk about the connection between food and community, which I think is important. We're going to have DTC people from outside the business, from New York City. We're going to bring in, to your point earlier, talk about psychographics and looking at your customer more broadly, calculating CAC, you know, Pareto's law, and then having experts do boot camps. So we're going to do 90-minute sessions where we're going to literally sit down and teach you how to do things. We've never done that before.
Nice.
So that's, I think, the point. We've always been a content-forward show, and now more than ever, that's what we want to be. I mean, we love our sponsors. That's why we can do it. It's a fundraiser for Free the Grapes, which, you know, makes us all able to ship wines across 47 states.
Yes.
So it's a good cause. It's for the cause. But it's more than anything else, I think it's a chance for the community to come together. And I think that now, more than ever, wines needs to hang together, or we will all hang separately. So you're a marketer. You need to be valued. Here's how you're going to do it. We're going to help people bring that interesting content.
And also just their own marketers. Like, get your people there and upskill your own marketers, because they are your customer advocate in the room. And the more they know, the stronger you are as a brand. So awesome.
That's so true. I think marketing people, I have always felt like I had the responsibility to represent the consumer in corporate boardrooms, in wine rooms, and to speak for those who are not there. And I take it seriously.
100%. Well, I will have the link to buy tickets in the show notes when this goes out. And Barbara, thank you so much. I'm grateful for your time. And I love everything that you said, like massive high fives from me. I know my team will be behind it. So really grateful.
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate it. And when you get over from Barcelona, let's have a glass of wine together in Sonoma.
I know. Perfect. I want to go to the DJ guy because I've heard about that brand, but I've never been there.